WLFP Braddock.
Good morning, Pittsburgh diners and travelers. Good afternoon to our overseas listeners. And good morning to Peter.
Good morning. Are we back to doing it the same old way?
Exactly.
And we have a guest on the line already this morning, but just in case you're wondering and whether you tuned into the right place, this is indeed On the Menu, a sort of radio internet program all about food, travel, and lifestyle. And there can't be much wrong with a book that has brownies on the cover.
That's true. We're talking now to... This is really your whole name, Kate? Sarah?
Yes, it is.
Sarah Kate Gillingham Ryan, with a hyphen, right?
That's right.
Okay. And you wrote the Grayston, or is it Greystone?
It's Grayston.
Grayston Bakery Cookbook. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
By way of introduction, there's a lot more to this book than what's
brownies.
On the cover. So don't read the book by the cover or whatever
right.
It's called. Tell us the story of Grayston, because it's very interesting.
The Grayston Bakery was started 25 years ago. This is their 25th birthday, by a group of Buddhist monks in New York City who were looking for a way to earn a little income for their community. And they opened a bakery, and it was in Riverdale, just north of New York. Pretty quickly moved out of Riverdale to a town just north of the city called Yonkers, and started to hire people who were directly coming from that community, which is a very impoverished city. It's a pretty major city in New York.
Yeah, I've been in Yonkers.
Yeah. it leaves an
impression, not very nice.
Yeah, exactly. There's some pretty fancy parts of Yonkers, too, but this is southwest Yonkers, probably the one you've seen. So they began to hire people from the community who were literally just out of prison, just out of rehab. Whatever stories they came with them, there was no judgment, and they were hired on a 3-week trial basis. They still have that hiring policy 25 years later. They've had a lot of success with it. A lot of people have, had food careers launched. A lot of people have just gotten back up on their feet by having a job at Grayston. Very soon after opening the bakery, they started responding to the other needs that their community had. You know, in order to work at a place like this, you might need childcare, single mothers. There were a lot of single mothers. You might need housing. So this is how the Grayston Foundation was born, by responding to all the other needs that their employees and the community around them had. So today, the foundation and the bakery, they're separate entities, but they do work together. And the profits of the bakery go to support the work that the foundation does, which is childcare, health care for people with HIV, housing, community gardens, so on.
So how large a foundation is this?
It's a $15 million annual budget, so pretty big.
And it stays in the community?
Yes. They serve southwest Yonkers, and then with some of the housing projects that they have, housing organizations, they move within the Westchester County, so it goes outside of Yonkers a bit.
This is an amazing story. Now there's an interesting connection with Ben and Jerry's. Can you explain that?
So the Grayston Bakery, which started by making all kinds of baked goods, and then pretty quickly started just focusing on sweets, cakes, tarts, and brownies, were approached by Ben and Jerry many years ago to start putting their brownies inside some of their ice cream flavors. And today, millions of people are eating Grayston brownies every day when they take a bite of several different Ben and Jerry's flavors.
Well, how did this man who set this up, I mean, he was a mathematician.
That's right.
And taught Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
How did he know about baking?
He didn't. But there is a place in San Francisco that was called the Tassajara Bakery, and that bakery was very well known.
Oh, I have that bread book. Is that the one that...
Exactly.
Okay.
And that was run by the Zen community of San Francisco. So a group of people, including, I believe, Bernie Glassman, who started the
whole organization. He's the founder.
I believe that they all went together and did a little bit of training out there. And there were some people who came and consulted on the New York end, and they learned together.
Amazing. Could you?
Now, Bernie Glassman. Now, that's a fine Buddhist name.
Exactly.
Well, could you do this link that between all these things, baking, living, spirituality. What is it that links everything together here? There is a philosophy involved with this.
There is, and interestingly enough, the organization was started, it was spiritually based in Buddhism, and now that's kind of blossomed a little bit into other faiths. There are a couple of Buddhists left, and 25 years later, that's actually an achievement that there's anyone left from the original group. There's the leader of the bakery, whose name is Julius Walls Jr., has a very strong Christian background. He considers himself sort of a minister of the community there because of the work he does with people. The connection, there are a lot of different connections. The main connection is just trying to do good in the world, and the way that they do good happens to be by baking and selling baked products, but it's really the work that goes on beyond the sugar and the chocolate and the flour. The work that they do with people to try to get them on their feet again, give them job training. It's just what a church does. It's just doing it by baking things that are not only pretty good but award-winning. So that's been just sort of icing on the cake, to extend the pun a little bit more, that Grayson has been so successful, even from a culinary standpoint, that they're so well-known just for how great their baked goods are.
So this, I guess when so you this, look- is a, this is a fascinating story, just for listeners to know the story, but I guess a lot of our listeners are probably also into the recipes that are in the book.
So that's right.
Well, you're skipping a step here.
I
wanted to say,
if you think back,
all the great nunneries produced signature cookies. Do you remember that?
That's right.
And all the monks produced liqueurs.
Right.
just shows you who was on the right track, doesn't it?
That's right.
But I wanted Sarah to trace. You started there, and you've gone on. You went on to work for other nonprofits, and then you moved into food. Is that?
Right. Well, I think I was always a little bit in food. I grew up. My mother was in the food business. I grew up in a very food-oriented home, and have always been interested and active in cooking and writing. And after a couple of attempts that eventually felt like kind of banging my head against a brick wall of working in the nonprofit field, I realized that it just wasn't my calling, and that the way that I could really do my best work was to do what I loved, which is something that I learned at Grayson. Actually, that's a tenet of Buddhism called right livelihood, which means sort of doing what makes best not only for the world but for yourself.
Oh, that's a good concept.
So in other words, if you know, just because you have a job in a social service agency that, you know, sounds like you're helping a lot of people, if you don't love your job, you're actually not doing the best you can do. So now that I love my job, I am writing about the things in the food world that matter to me. And that's, I believe, how this project came along. It was kind of the perfect combination of my food writing background and my nonprofit background. I just started writing. I went to the French Culinary Institute, so I have a little bit of culinary training as well. And most of the issues I write about are around food rituals, food and spirituality here in this book. I'm very interested in the, you know, local and organic movements. A big hot topic now. All the things that have to do with doing good with food is
exactly
interests me. So that's why this book was just an amazing opportunity.
Now, may I suggest that anyone interested in getting this book can go directly to our website, www.onthemenuradio.com, and click on OTM Bookshelf and search the page for this called...
Did I put it there yet?
Well,
if I didn't put it there yet, it's going to be, folks, it's going to be there very soon.
I think it's there.
I think it's there?
Thought,
okay.
I thought so.
That's great.
Anyhow, but the recipes itself, the story is interesting, but Rabbit, read some of these recipes.
These are also damn good recipes.
Yeah, they are.
And we got apple tort. But I guess the favorite section probably has to be the brownie section.
That's the popular one,
yes. That's the popular one. Okay, there you go.
Well, because Grayson is so well known for their brownies. But, you know, they used to make cakes and tarts. They don't make them anymore unless on special order. But a lot of those recipes are in this book. So people who know Grayson Bakery from a few years ago know that their cheesecakes were delicious, their layer cakes, their chocolate mousse layer cake, amazing. So those recipes are in the book as well.
Yeah, you've
incorporated some too. I see there's one. Everybody here in where we're broadcasting from in Pittsburgh loves burnt almond tort. From Prantl's Bakery on Walnut Street.
Uh-huh.
But you say you got the recipe from a little restaurant in northern Spain.
I was in Spain when I was writing the book, and it was at the point where I was kind of grasping at straws for just the last few recipes to come up with, you know, as it says on the cover, more than 80 recipes from a bakery that a lot of these recipes are inspired by their inventory. So Grayson has not made all of these recipes. So I had to come up with many on my own, and I was at the sort of tail end of the project, and served to me was I was on a wine tour in Rioja for a writing job, and was this beautiful tort, and they scribbled it on a napkin, and I translated it both out of Spanish and out of metric. So there were two.
Yeah, I've had to do that.
And it's delicious.
It reads deliciously. This whole book reads deliciously.
It is. The book is delicious. Everybody should get this. And do you have a website for the Grayston Foundation?
It's grayston.org, GREYSTON.ORG.
And how about for you personally?
I edit a site called Apartment Therapy. And if you go on apartmenttherapy.com, there's a site called The Kitchen. And that is... it's our sort of our online magazine that I edit and sometimes also write.
Well, listen, this has been a delight, and I thank you very much for calling us. And I hope everybody will enjoy this book, and I wish you luck in your writing.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for joining us, and think brownies, right?
Yes, exactly.
Thanks, Sarah.
Bye-bye.
It's time to take a break now.
Hi, my name is Suzanne Ferguson, and I'm the owner of Suzanne Ferguson & Associates. I'm the coach that helps you get what you say you want. Are you getting what you want out of your business? Do you and your staff always reach your goals? At the end of each day, each quarter, each year, are you totally satisfied with your productivity and profitability? I'm a professional coach, and my business is completely dedicated to helping my clients make changes within their lives and business that result in increased productivity and profitability. None of us has 20/20 vision on ourselves. My clients tell me that what makes my approach unique is that I bring a fresh perspective that allows their new ideas and actions to come forth. What kinds of changes do you want to make? Increased productivity? New leadership skills? Restructuring and reorganizing? Whatever the change, if you want to do it more quickly and more easily, contact me, Suzanne Ferguson of Suzanne Ferguson & Associates, for a free coaching session. 412-727-7299, www.sfacoaching.com.
You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Visit our website, onthemenuradio.com, and you'll find, I hope, that we're going to be strongly recommending a new product called Brooker London Dry Gin.
I think it's Brooker. Isn't it? Brooker. And we have the producer online?
Andy Dawson is on the line, a Londoner. And Andy, welcome.
Thank you, Anne and Peter. Hello.
We're laughing because we thought it was funny to see the bottle with the little plastic...
It's a bowler hat.
Bowler hat on it.
And those of you who don't know what a bowler hat is, looks like, you'd better Google it so you can find out, because we don't have time to talk about it on the program.
But Andy's photos are always... He's always wearing a bowler.
But
hello, Andy?
Yes, that's correct. Maybe I should just explain that our Brooker's London Dry Gin is themed on a London stockbroker who traditionally would have worn a bowler hat and carried an umbrella and perhaps a Financial Times under his arm.
Actually, the first time I was in London, that's exactly how it was.
Yeah, and they probably and they all wore dark coats and striped pants.
That's it.
And looked very, very formal. And now they probably rush around in hush puppies and sandals and jeans and. But there are still brokers out there, and I'm sure they celebrate this gin. Now, is this a new product, Andy?
It's relatively new. My brother and I started making it about 7 years ago, and our intention was to recreate the style of London dry gin that was made 200 years ago. We've been selling it in the U.S. now for 5 years, and we have distribution in about 40 states.
Wow, well, that's really terrific. Well done.
And what is distinctive about this gin, which I loved, and I'm not even a regular gin drinker?
Well, the first thing to say about premium gins is that traditionally they've been made with grain spirit and a set of botanicals, always led by juniper berries. Now, in recent years, a number of new gins have come onto the market which have tried to make themselves different by having unusual botanicals or using spirits other than pure grain spirit. Our goal was to recreate a traditional gin using traditional ingredients, and that's what we did. And in particular, we wanted to make a gin that was very rich in aroma and full in flavor.
Well, this
is
true.
I often describe Brokers as being a full-on gin for the committed gin drinker.
Yeah, I mean, it has so much more flavor. It makes everything else taste like lab alcohol.
Now, so if I were to take an example here, Andy, you would say that Hendrick's gin, which is made with cucumber, is a perversion of gin?
Well, I wouldn't go quite that far.
See, I'm trying to suck you in here.
On a different dimension, Peter, which is this. The simplest way of describing gin is it's the original flavored vodka. But instead of being flavored with cranberry or orange or whatever the flavor of the moment is, it's a neutral grain spirit flavored with juniper berries and other botanicals, most of which are spices and fruits. Now, some gins have a light infusion of those botanicals and are therefore closer to vodka in style. Other gins have a richer infusion, and we have deliberately gone for a very rich infusion to give a very flavorful gin.
It has an herby taste to it.
Yes. I mean, if you look at some of the things in the gin, apart from the juniper berry, we use cinnamon, nutmeg, licorice, orange peel, lemon peel, and different people with their palates notice different things. A lot of people notice the slight inclusion of the citrus element, for example.
Yes.
Now, how did you and your brother have the idea that your future in life was to invent a new kind of gin or an old kind of gin? I mean, it's not exact. It doesn't seem like a sort of a spur-of-the-moment thing.
My brother, Martin, had been working in the drinks industry for 25 years. I had been working in the oil and gas industry for 25 years. And the simplest way I can explain what happened to me is that time drove me to drink. and we had both always enjoyed gin, and we felt that the gin market was a little bit quiet. Now, in recent years, it's become a subject of renewed interest, and we wanted to contribute to that renewal of interest in gin by putting a new gin out there that we thought people would enjoy.
Now, this is the gin is produced in Britain, correct?
Yes. I mean, traditionally, most London dry gins are made in England, certainly the premium varieties. And we make our Brokers gin in a 200-year-old distillery outside Birmingham in England.
Oh, okay. Do you? Birmingham, huh?
It's a place. You know, if you think about gin in general, in the UK now, there are only about 5 or 6 gin distilleries left. And they were sited in places where there were good sources of underground spring water, because it's important to have a source of pure soft water for distilling. And the distillery that we use was located for that reason and has been doing nothing but making gin for 200 years.
So it was making another kind of gin?
The distillery we use makes a number of different gins for private label customers, of which we are one.
Okay, I got you. Now, are you familiar with a gin called, I think it's Blackwood?
Yes.
Which is made, of all things, in the Shetland Islands or Orkneys? It seemed like an odd place to make gin, but...
Well, I know the Shetlands quite well because I used to work in the oil and gas industry, and the Shetlands is up in that part of the country. Now, what I know about Blackwoods is that all the botanicals they use are grown on the Shetlands.
Oh, wow.
Now,
there you go.
Conventional botanicals for gin include a number of items which are tree bark, cinnamon and cassia. And on the Shetlands, there aren't any trees. botanicals that come from bark. So instead they have some other ingredients which are of what I would call the unconventional variety.
Now, in the before you came on the program live, we were talking about the history of gin. And although Britain has perfected gin, it was really invented somewhere else, correct?
That's right. It was invented in Holland by a pharmacist, and this goes back as far as the 16th century. He was working with alcoholic spirit that had long been used for medicinal purposes and juniper berries, which were known to have diuretic properties. And he kidney medicine.
Hey, take note of that.
Oh, okay, so it was
take
a kidney
note
but
of that, rabbit.
But then somehow or other the
well,
alcohol content got up.
Well, they discovered that their medicine tasted really good. So he and his pal started drinking it, not just for the benefit of their kidneys.
Maybe it the opposite, to the detriment of their
maybe
kidneys.
It helped them deal with the patients, huh?
But then what happened was the gin-making idea was carried over to England. A Dutch prince became king of England.
Oh, so William of Orange brought it over with him.
Exactly. And also English soldiers who had fought with the Dutch in European wars had become used to being given a shot of Geneva, as it was called, before going into battle.
Uh-huh.
Hence the expression Dutch courage. And
when
they came back to England, they wanted to make their own gin.
Just like the Navy used to dish out rum, the Army used to dish out gin.
Exactly.
I never knew that.
Exactly.
You listening to this program, folks, you learn all kinds of important historical things.
Right.
And then perhaps it's worth noting that, you know, after gin became very popular, most of the ways it was drunk were believed to have medicinal benefit. The one that most people know about is gin and tonic, and the quinine in tonic water is preventative against malaria and was drunk in places like India and Africa and Malaya for that reason.
Well, it wasn't all viewed as beneficial. I mean, we do have Hogarth.
So like many things, you know, gin went through a bad patch, and the government then decided they had to do something about it. So they did what governments normally do, which is introduce taxes and regulations.
Sin taxes.
And after that, gin improved a lot.
Now,
well, let's make sure that listeners across the country and across the world, if it's available anywhere else, know how to find brokers. So how can they do that, Andy?
Well, in the U.S., as I mentioned, it's available in about 40 states. So anyone can go into their liquor store and look for or ask for Broker's Gin. In the U.S., it's also available over the Internet from a number of places. The one that I know is quite well known is Sam's of Chicago, Sam's Wine and Spirit. So that's one place.
What's the address?
If you just look up on the Internet, Sam's Wines and Spirits, you'll find it, and you'll find Broker's Gin available from them.
Okay, so people should Google that. You don't actually happen to know their website?
Not directly, okay. but you'll find it if you just Google Sam's Wines and Spirits. Another one is called Binny's. Binnys, and again, that comes up on Google.
Great. Well, we'll make sure that those get put into the favorite section of our website just as soon as I can get around to doing that. Now, do you have a website? Are you reachable yourself?
We have a website which is simply brokersgin.com.
Okay, brokersgin.
Or www.brokersgin.com.
Gotcha.
Okay, so we can link that up on our website, actually.
And you can be a model of a modern major general or whatever Gilbert and Sullivan might say about that.
Well, tell me this.
Here's a little tidbit for you.
Okay.
WWW is apparently the only three-letter acronym that takes longer to say than the words it replaces.
well, you know who invented it, of course.
No, I don't.
The whole concept of the World Wide Web and URLs and all that kind of stuff was invented by an Englishman called Dr. Timothy Berners-Lee.
Ah, okay.
Who was actually at the CERN nuclear research facility in Europe at the time, and he's now at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, where he runs a group called I think it's called the World Wide Web Foundation or something like that.
Huh.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
So he's responsible for the fact that we have these things called URLs. Most people, when you say, what's the URL, they don't have any idea what you're talking about. But if you say www, then they catch on right away.
Okay.
In Italy, they say voo, voo, voo.
Well, that's a lot shorter.
Because there's no W in the alphabet.
Well, anyhow, is there any word that you want to leave our listeners with?
Well, maybe I'll say this. A lot of people like to drink cocktails. One of the key things about a good gin, like Broker's Gin, is that it has its own flavor and character, and it doesn't beg to be made into a cocktail. In that sense, it's a bit like a malt whiskey or a fine cognac. So I often think that the best way to drink Broker's Gin is the simple ways, such as a gin and tonic or a martini. And I like the style of martini that Winston Churchill drank, which is the very dry style. He said that you should merely look at the vermouth bottle on the other side of the room while you pour the gin.
Sounds like my kind of guy. Sounds like my kind of prescription. I might have one tonight at dinner time.
Yeah. Now you made up cocktails though, didn't you?
We have. I mean, and one of the ways to distinguish one type of cocktail from another is whether it's sweet or not. Now, personally, I prefer drinks which are not sweet.
Me too.
I'm conscious that a lot of people like sweet drinks. And one of the ones that we have created at Broker's, which is sweet, and it looks beautiful because it's blue, it's called the Broker's Blue Ocean. And that involves Broker's dry gin mixed with peach schnapps, freshly squeezed lime juice, and blue curacao, plus some simple syrup to taste. So that would be an example of a fine cocktail that people who have a sweet tooth would like.
And you could also marinate chicken in it.
Well, there's a whole history
Can you hang on for a minute? We need to take a break.
Okay.
Could you hang on for a bit?
Certainly.
Thanks. We'll take a break.
The internet is crucial to your business. Everybody knows this, but did you know Nidhogg is the company you should call for internet service? Nidhogg, personal web page hosting for less. Business web page hosting, Nidhogg offers both Unix and NT server support. Nidhogg is the company you should call for dedicated internet access. Nidhogg offers DSL for high speed, low cost, always on access. DSL is great. It means no more dial up. Oh, by the way, do you remember that thing called the telephone? Do you remember when people used phone lines to access the internet? Oh, I'm sorry, you still use dial-up? Well, Nidhogg does that too. Local access telephone numbers? Okay, I don't understand it all either, but I do know that I need it, and I know where to get it. Nidhogg, Nidhogg.com, 412-661-5917. That's 661-5917, or log on, Nidhogg.com. Internet the Nidhogg way.
The flagship station of the Lifestyle Talk Radio Network. This is 1550 WLFP, Pittsburgh.
Hi, friends. I'm Phil Marcus, the host of Real Estate 101, heard every Saturday here on The Edge, AM 1550. If you've been thinking about selling your house or buying a house, I'd like to speak with you. Choosing the right agent is one of the first and most important steps in the process of buying or selling real estate. It's critical that you choose an agent who has the knowledge and experience to not only find that perfect new home for you, but to also be able to guide you step by step through the often complicated real estate process. If you don't already have a realtor, may I offer my services? I've been a real estate agent in Pittsburgh for almost 30 years. I'm a life member of the Realtors Association, and I'm proud to say that I've earned both the GRI and the coveted CRS professional designations. Won't you call me at RE/MAX Heritage? The phone number is 412-241-4200, extension 154, or my email address is phil@philmarcus.com. That's 412-241-4200, extension 154, or phil@philmarcus.com. Let's talk.
Welcome back to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And we now have two guests on the line, and it's become a drinking program.
It's a beverage-laden On the Menu program because Rick Cushman, who together with Hank Beale just produced the definitive guide to the Napa wine country in a book called The Movable First.
You loved this book, didn't
you? Welcome, Rick.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, Rick.
And Andy's still with us because he can't abide missing out on knowing more about how to navigate Napa wine country. But let me put this book in a nutshell. This is the book that Sideways, the movie, ought to have been.
Yes.
And was there something about Sideways, the movie, that caused you to write the book?
Not at all.
Not at all. It seemed,
although it did help us market the book.
There you go. I mean, it seemed to me that Sideways was such a silly movie. I can't possibly understand how people were excited about it, except that it did have one or two funny moments.
Yeah, and it was fun, and it was one of those sort of first. Wine is becoming such a popular drink now. In fact, it just passed beer as the most popular adult beverage in the United States.
Oh, I just heard from the Brewers Association the beer just passed the
wine. Yeah, it's going back and forth. It's like year to year, but you know, it's. But what it is wine is becoming a very popular, you know, it's no longer the snob thing, or people are losing their fear of wine, and Sideways sort of played to that. And frankly, our book is very much in that sort of popular vein, although not at all like Sideways. It's, you know, we say it's Sideways if it had really been about wine.
Yeah.
But I am, in my day job, I'm a television critic. I'm the TV critic for the Sacramento Bee out in California.
Oh, no kidding.
Oh, how funny.
And my best friend is Hank Beal, and he's the executive wine buyer for Nugget Market, which is an upscale supermarket chain.
So there he goes.
He's a wine pro. I'm basically best described as a happy wine idiot, or I was anyway, and we went through to every public tasting room in the Napa Valley during one wine season.
Yeah, let me just introduce this. Andy will relate to this because I remember hearing this story back when I was much younger and more impressionable, that in the 18th century there was an English gentleman who decided that he would make it his career to drink beer in every inn in the United Kingdom. And he was on his second time around when he died.
Good way to go.
So
I think it took him more than a week.
and you did 141
yes.
Napa tasting rooms.
Yes.
And I'm wondering how your liver is doing.
Well, you know, it's recovering. I hate to say this to tell Andy this, but we pretty much stopped the mixed drinks because we're drinking so much wine these days. Among the things that this book is, it's taking basically a guy like me, who's your average normal person, and sort of getting him up to speed to be sort of fluent in the world of wine. And so among the things I learned to do was spit. And I might add, not well.
there you go.
The book starts with me learning how to spit and basically coming to the conclusion that our first recommendation is wear dark colors. But it's that kind of a book. And as we moved along, you know, I became a little more sophisticated. And now when I spit, I just leave a little small drop on the chin. I'm much better now.
Let me just give people a feeling for this book by just reading a couple of sentences. This is on page 55. So what have we learned? A lot and nothing. It's pretty simple. This is talking about pairings. Everyone is right. Are there pairings that go well? Yes. I stumbled onto two great ones today, and this is one you congratulate yourself on. Are there some that suck? Yes, and it starts with beets.
Nothing ever goes with beets. And
gin. Hey, how about gin?
I'm sorry? Well, you know, actually,
gin with beets, yeah.
Gin would go with beets, I'll bet.
What do you think, Andy?
Well, I think gin is perhaps something you cook with more than drink with food. I mean, traditionally in Britain, gin is what you would drink before a meal. But historically, gin has been used in cooking. And if I give you a couple of examples, it's very good for marinating game. And venison would be an example where if you marinate the venison in gin and then cook it with a sauce, including juniper berries, you've got a great dish.
What about choucroute? I used to go through a whole bottle of gin and with the choucroute and the juniper berries layer, didn't I, Rabbit?
Yeah. I think there was some gin.
Dry vermouth.
It was dry vermouth and gin. So it was
and
sort of like
juniper berries, yes. And cloves.
Can I tell Andy that I found that gin really aids my cooking because I drink it while I cook.
There you go.
That's another good thing to do.
So yes. It releases the inhibitions
exactly.
Which would otherwise get in the way of your cooking. But this is really two books in one, I think.
Yes.
I mean, it's a storybook about how Hank helped you to understand wine better.
Yes. And you know, we thought, I mean, one of the pushes behind the book was, as a guy who loved wine and liked reading about it, I just found that wine books were so impenetrable. They're either written at a level that was just way over my head, as if Bacchus himself wrote the words, or they tend to be like school books, you know, sort of tutorials. And this is this cheerful adventure of these two guys, and you learn about wine, and you learn about Napa, and you know, and meanwhile, we hope that you're enjoying the ride with us. And in the back is the guidebook to the 141 tasting rooms out there.
Yeah, and are our favorites in there?
Where'd
you start?
did you miss one out?
Well, you know, no. What we did was we chose, we call them the public tasting rooms. There are, the idea was this was a readily accessible kinds of places, places that you could just drive up to and go in or get in with a phone call or the night before if you're in Napa or heading out to Napa. There's some places that, because of permit restrictions, can only take a couple visitors. In fact, there's one winery up on top of the hill that can take 2 visitors a month. So if Hank and I went, nobody could go until the next month.
Which is that?
That is actually one of the wineries in they have a tasting room in downtown Napa. It is I'm blanking at the moment. I'll come to it by the end of the show. It's but they do have a tasting room in the center of Napa that you can taste there. But the winery, they just is opened up a tasting room up on their mountainside hill. They're up up in the Vaca Mountains, which is the east side of the valley. And
we like Pat Coletto's.
Oh, Coletto is wonderful. And Coletto is a reservation-only place.
Yeah, we had lunch there. It was absolutely spectacular. His personal chef cooked.
And everything was
produced on the estate.
Yeah, we drank
rabbits.
We drank one of every wine that he made, I think.
It was a wonderful thing.
For somebody who's never been there, Coletto is a restaurateur who's some terrific restaurants like Farallon in San Francisco and Martini House in St. Helena in Napa Valley. And the place has just a magic to it. It almost feels like you expect unicorns to be wandering the property.
Oh, isn't it fabulous? Yeah.
He's actually getting ready to open a new place in Bodega Bay called Nick's.
Yes, so I understand.
And I think
I'm sure it will be, you know, he has the gift of making places feel slightly larger than life, but not kitschy.
Well, look at him.
he's the guy, yeah.
He's larger than life, but certainly not kitschy.
Yes.
Andy, before I forget, I wanted to ask you, do you ever get to Simpson's restaurant?
It's in Birmingham.
In London?
No,
Birmingham.
No, the one in Birmingham.
No, I haven't been to the one in Birmingham, no.
Well,
Go there
and take them a sample of your gin and tell them Ann and Peter Haig from On the Menu sent you.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll do that next time I'm there. Thank you.
And I'm sure they'll take care of it. It's Simpsons. They call themselves a restaurant with rooms.
Yeah. Okay. But we've stayed there too. It's really.
But the food's absolutely terrific. But back to Napa then. So what are the problems that I see, Rick? Is you have so much information in the book. I mean, how would you deal with trying to visit all 141 tasting rooms? I mean, how would someone use your book to choose the ones they might like to go to?
Well, we've done a couple of things. We put some basic tips. There's the two sections. There's the narrative section, and then the second half of the book is the tips and the guide. And we put a lot of tips in the front, really sort of how to think about a trip. Like, you know, if you're going for a day, we say, you know, plan on 3 or 4, maybe do one tour, plan to picnic somewhere or have lunch somewhere. And then we've organized it by regions. And it's, you know, we started at the south of the valley and worked our way north as the wine season went along. So we chronicled the year on the vine as well. So you could use that book by simply sort of skimming through and looking at either different places that you'd like or kinds of things that you'd want to go to. The problem, of course, you know, it's a good problem. The problem is there's just so many places to go to Napa. And we describe them all, and we sort of recommend them for the kind of taster that you are, whether it's in, like some places, Ragushi is a great example. It's a small, mid-sized winery, actually, up on the Silverado Trail in the southern part of the valley. And they welcome everyone, but they tend to be more aimed at sort of advanced tasters. There's not a lot of fancy things in the tasting room, and it's a very pretty old world room and looks out over the valley. And that's the kind of place that if you've been to Napa a lot and you haven't been to there, you should go. And it says for advanced tasters. And there's other places like the bigger wines like Beringer and Mondavi. And those are really good for first time people because they have really complete tours And so we, in the book, we say, you know, for everyone, especially for beginners and that sort of thing.
Those tours are too long.
Yeah, some of them are, and it really depends. And see, and we talk about this too. For folks like you who've been around a while, you know, you kind of want to see what makes say why Mondavi Winery is different from somebody else. And so for you, it's probably not that tour. For you, a tour might be a smaller place, like we really loved up in the north end of the valley, Tudal, which is a little tiny winery, family owned for, you know, the last 25 years. They make a great cab, one of the best cabs in the valley, actually, and it's only $35. And there, that's just basically, you're going to stand there and talk to the winemaker, and he'll show you around a little bit and tell you what they do that's different in your taste. And that's, you know, for advanced people, that's a great place. But for someone who's never been to wine country, Mondavi is a great stop because they tell you how they make wine, and if you didn't know that, it is sort of eye-opening.
I'm just waiting for a review copy of the House of Mondavi.
Yeah, I mean we went to BV before Francis Ford Coppola bought it and made it to his house.
Yeah. Oh, right.
We've been going there for a long time, but
that is a while ago.
But 29 really got terribly crowded.
Well, and we talk about that in the book too. We have a couple of ways of dealing with the crowds. One of the things we say is if you're going in busy times, always turn right. You know,
it
sounds so simple, but you know, you just can't make a left turn, and so you move in one direction. But there's other ways to do it. Go off to the Silverado Trail, which is the other north-south artery.
Yeah, we like that much better.
Right. The other thing is everybody goes to Napa. They, you know, they come into the bottom of the valley, and they move north as the day goes on. So as on a busy Saturday, what you should do is either start north and go south or just stay in the southern end of the valley. And you know, there's lovely wineries in Carneros and down the Oaknell district, and the crowds will have moved away from you.
Well, you sure have a lot of information, Rick. And as I said, Peter loves his book. We're planning a trip now to go to California again.
Yeah, we'll fill in the blanks. If there are any blanks in the schedule, we'll fill them in.
There you go. Are you going to spend much time in Napa Valley?
We come back and forth.
We're going into San Francisco. We're going to go up to Sonoma. So I think if I pull it off, it's going to be about a week altogether.
But and we were just there also.
We were there. We were in Sonoma in October.
Another great place for folks that haven't been to the Northern California. And, you know, we decided to limit it to Napa for a couple of reasons. One, because you need a finite limit, but also because Napa Valley is, in essence, the ground zero in American wine. It's where all the trends come from. It's where so much of the good wine is. But it's also the attitude in a place like Napa, which is that there's so many people there simply because they love wine. And it's kind of the national sport of the valley. And everywhere you go, people talk wine and talk food and wine pairings. And it's just, so we decided to contract it. But places like Sonoma and, my gosh, San Francisco, some of the great food on the planet, I think.
Great. Well, I think, are we taking a break now?
Yeah, we have to take a break now, but I want to thank both of you for showing up and talking to us, and congratulations on your book, Rick, and your fabulous gin, Andy.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, and keep in touch with us.
Yeah, what do we say? Bottoms up, right?
Bottoms That's up, good. You guys. Thank you for calling, both of you.
Sure. Thanks a lot.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Bye. And we'll take a break now.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Join us for the Apollo Moon Landing Celebration July 17th through the 21st, Apollo PA. 5 great days of family fun, featuring the award-winning Katanning Fireman's Band, games and rides for the kids, nightly entertainment, food. It's just good old summer fun. The Apollo Moon Landing Celebration, July 17th through the 21st at Owens Field in Apollo.
Roger. We copy you down, Eagle.
Hi, my name is Suzanne Ferguson, and I'm the owner of Suzanne Ferguson & Associates. I'm the coach that helps you get what you say you want. Are you getting what you want out of your business? Do you and your staff always reach your goals? At the end of each day, each quarter, each year, are you totally satisfied with your productivity and profitability? I'm a professional coach, and my business is completely dedicated to helping my clients make changes within their lives and business that result in increased productivity and profitability. None of us has 20/20 vision on ourselves. My clients tell me that what makes my approach unique is that I bring a fresh perspective that allows their new ideas and actions to come forth. What kinds of changes do you want to make? Increase productivity? new leadership skills, restructuring and reorganizing. Whatever the change, if you want to do it more quickly and more easily, contact me, Suzanne Ferguson of Suzanne Ferguson & Associates, for a free coaching session. 412-727-7299, www.sfacoaching.com.
Woo! On the menus, on a whirlwind.
Yeah, we're back though. We must banish thoughts of Napa Valley wine and London Dry Gin,
right,
from our thoughts for the moment.
And we're going south again.
We're going south, back to revisit an old friend.
We've talked before with Chef Bob Wagner at Charleston Grill, and of course Charleston, South Carolina, and this was an exciting return, revisit of a restaurant that's been totally redesigned and also a brand new menu. Hello, Bob.
How are you? Glad to be here.
Tell us, first of all, what the redesign did. I mean, it brightened it, didn't it?
Definitely brightened up the room. And that was actually the goal. I mean, I've been here 10 years now, and I think the hotel side, when you see a hotel of this stature, what they've done is they've put just a ton of money into redoing the spa. They spent a lot of money on a beautiful spa upstairs 3-4 years ago. Last year, put a bunch of money into a beautiful bar in the lobby that they've spent a lot of money on. And this was actually just, I mean, we're thinking of this big, huge, giant change, but really what it is was a following of the hotel of really, I think, thanking the people, the local people of their business over the last 10, 15, 20 years almost now. And it was sort of their bonus of saying, you know, we've done this, we've done our thing, let's brighten it up, make it a little more lively for the, you know, the locals that have supported us over the years.
And it's true. I mean, everything is brightened. The vista here out into the garden, it's such a pleasure being here. Now let's talk to the issue of this new menu. I think it is brilliant. You've divided one menu into actually four menus: pure, lush, cosmopolitan, and southern. Could you explain each one?
Well, actually, what we've done, and I can't really even take any credit for it, was my sous chef's idea. We were all sitting around a table one day, and we were thinking about obviously changing the dining room around and listening to people's wants and needs over the last 10 years also as a chef here. And people's dining habits have changed over the years. People dine often and are looking for some lighter things, and some are looking for the wonderful, lush, beautiful, sort of French-inspired southern dishes that I do and have done for 10 years. And then there's other folks that are really looking for something pure and simple, that eat out maybe 3-4 times a week and really just want to sit at the bar and have a grilled piece of fish and, you know, a little lemon on top, just something simple rather than going through an entire dinner and sitting down. And they can just sit in and, you know, and not worry so much about the whole elegant evening, if you will. They can come in and have a good time and just grab something to eat because they live around the corner.
And it taps into your experience with French cuisine and techniques, too.
Oh, it definitely does. I mean, everything, I can't say that there's not a lot of French in everything I do after spending 11 years there. But now we sort of have a fun play on things with our lush, obviously being very very French influenced, and then the pure side, playing with really just, as with the other products we have on the menu, is just buying the best possible product we can find, whether it's the, you know, whether it's the lamb or even a great caviar or the best lobster we can find, or local fish and local salads and local flowers and things that we use in a lot of the dishes, and baby cucumbers or zucchini blossoms. And the goal really is to find, A, the best product in any of the quadrants that you'll find over our menu. But now we've got a sort of a fun play on the cosmopolitan side where we'll play with some Italian dishes or play with some Hawaiian fish. And it makes it fun for us and a little bit different things than what we've done before, and people are getting a kick out of it.
I marked some of the food that we had. We had the foie gras with kumquat jam and vanilla maple syrup. That's rich.
Oh yeah, that was definitely rich, but just tiny. You know, you want to play on that sort of fattiness of the foie gras. So we did this wonderful kumquat jam. If you can see the kumquats out there growing in the garden, that we've cooked those guys down. So you a little bit of sweetness and a little bit of vanilla maple syrup. That actually they make these this incredible maple syrup and age it in bourbon barrels for a year. So it's got this tiny hint of bourbon and fresh vanilla in it. So it's just a little drizzle. There's not a lot of sauce or anything. So it's just a little drizzle alongside of it, kind of a play on it with the sweetness and a little bit of tartness also with the kumquat. So it's sort of a fun starter.
That's on the lush menu. Also from there, we had venison with porcini mushroom risotto. Now that was gorgeous.
That was as lush as it gets. This is this incredible venison that we've been been able to get our hands on. And the porcini mushrooms are just spectacular at this time of year. And alongside that, we have little baby yellow carrots that we julienne, and little tiny micro white asparagus, and little baby snow peas that are julienned up, and the fresh start of the summer truffles that are coming into season also. So it's just definitely on our lusher side of the menu.
Now, I mean, the listeners, the presentations are like little jewels as they come to these plates. They're just exquisite. Pure, well, there's so many things on your pure, but we sampled the lamb chop.
You did, and these are dry-aged Colorado lamb chops, which I would put up against any lamb in France after spending so much time in France. And this is really the push to our pure side, is really the best possible product you can find. I've never tasted better lamb than this. And what we do is we simply grill it. What we'll do is we'll sear it ahead of time with the entire chop rack itself and try and eliminate as much of the fat as we can off that, keeping to that pure side. But we leave that fat on, that grilled fat that's still on the bones. And some people that don't want it won't eat it, but like there was a gentleman last night who was saying, "Do you see any fat on mine?" And he had them in his hand, and he was whittling away at them just because it's so good. But definitely on the pure side, and just a little lamb juice drizzled across the top with some fresh parsley, and that was it. A little potato galette that we do with it, and some white asparagus just gently tossed in some oil, and a little simple seasoning, and that's one of our biggest hits on the menu.
Hey, we have Southern. That is a delicious Charleston grill crab cake. That is one delicious. Peter said this sets a whole new standard for crab cake.
Yeah, I think over the years we've tried to get, you try and get better with everything that you do, and now the goal with crab cakes, and I think most people's complaint with any crab cake, and folks from Maryland can rave about their crab cakes, but whenever you're having crab cakes, I think the biggest complaint for most people is the amount of filler that people put in most crab cakes. And ours, I mean, we literally buy the best crab meat that we can find and just barely bind it together with the least amount of anything that we put in it, just to barely hold it together. And it's all crab. I mean, it's a big old crab cake with fun crab meat. And the local shrimp are coming into season right now. So we've got our southern shrimp. And then we just do a light little vinaigrette rather than having a heavy sauce or a cream sauce or anything like that. Just a little julienne of the fresh wild American shrimp, little lime and fresh tomatoes, and a little dill olive oil vinaigrette that goes across the top of it. So it makes it tasty and no filler. Which is
Bob, I'm in love with your pastry chef. Could you tell us a little bit about him?
Vincent Aschbacher, born in Austria on the border of Italy. So obviously, depending on who's winning the World Cup that year, he'll say he's Italian or Austrian. And spent a lot of time in Germany also, so it could be the Germans winning. But has been here almost 7 years now, and a true bonus to the end of any meal at the Charleston Grill is any of the goodies. And we almost have that same little play on the Southern, so we'll do some Southern crisps and cobblers and fun stuff like that, and then we'll throw in a true French creme brulee, which is by far the best in the city, or the state for that matter, and some lighter things like a lemon mousse souffle that's kind of fun, and there's incredible ice creams and fun sorbets of different sorts and wacky concoctions of preparations and fun presentations and little petit fours to finish off your evening. So it's oh, and there's a chocolate thing, and all total chocolate is what we call it. And there's a, you know, five little goodies of different types of chocolates and from different parts of the different countries actually, and done in different ways, and make for just an incredible finish to a fun meal.
Well, he's a treasure, and also, if I could mention, your sommelier.
Yeah, Rick Rubel. He's a huge new addition also with Sarah, his assistant, who've just turned our wine list around and added tons of wonderful, incredible bottles. And most, I must say, at lower, truly great rates where you can find some things and find new bottles rather than trying to search in and, you know, having to go up to the big bottle prices to find some new things. So a lot of new additions from a lot of different countries, and have written it in a way where it's easy to read and easy to flip through and find something fun and sometimes whimsical, even for desserts, a lot of fun. And actually some half bottles now, too, which really make it fun.
You know, I just want to say that this place was, as a total experience, one of the best experiences we've had.
Yeah.
From the rooms, the club that runs all day long.
You want to be taken care of.
Yeah,
this is a place to be taken care of.
And this kitchen crew, I mean, this chef is so talented, experienced, brilliant.
Yep, everything.
And his whole team is.
Everything. Now, one of the reasons we discovered things run so smoothly is because of the next character that we're going to interview.
And he is a character.
Who's the general manager of the restaurant. And, you'll get the drift. Mickey Baxt is the general manager of the Charleston Grill. We just heard from Chef Bob Wagoner. So my first question of Mickey is, okay, so Bob's in charge, right? But you're the general manager. So tell me how that works.
It works easily. Bob takes care of the kitchen. I take care of the front. And we get together to meet and figure out how to make everything work. It's a simple arrangement. I never go back into the kitchen and say, do this, do this, do this. Bob has his ideas, his menus. He gets input from others. And then my job is to bring that picture out into the dining room. So the marriage works really well, and it works very smoothly.
Now, who's the boss?
I don't think there is one. Paul, are you the boss? Paul's the boss, and it's neither of us. We just sort of do what we do every day. Actually, Bob just said it. The guest is the boss. Our goal is to make people happy here. Our goal is to have people walk out, and their response to what we do dictates what we do. Bob talked to you about changing the restaurant. The customer dictated to us a need to lighten up the restaurant, a need to make it look a little brighter and make it a little bit more approachable. And so we responded in kind, and as a result, they're coming back in droves, which is a wonderful thing. So the boss, I mean, we both work for an incredible organization, the Orient Express via the Charleston Place Hotel. You're going to be talking to our general manager of the hotel, Paul Stracy. He sort of gives us a lot of freedom and still at the same time looks at what we're doing, and then we execute.
Now, you got here, I understand, by invitation.
Well, Bob had cooked at my last restaurant where I was in Detroit, a restaurant called Tribute in Detroit, Michigan. We had an absolutely great weekend, just a spectacular weekend. I left Tribute, and at one point Bob said, you know, I'm looking for somebody here. Why don't we talk about it? My wife and I had been down here a couple of times, and I say this to this day, I had one of the greatest meals of my life that Bob cooked for me here in this hotel restaurant. And as a result, coming down here and Charleston as a whole, the whole package was quite good.
Now, you also imported another important person. Bob talked a little bit about your sommelier, Rick. He's a real treasure too, isn't he?
Rick Rubel was in Detroit also. He ran 14 different wine programs, and to be honest, I needed a lot of help. We're very proud here at the Charleston Grill. We have an incredible wine list with about 1,500 different labels. And to run the dining room and do the wine list at the same time was just too burdensome of a challenge. And Rick has come down, and as Bob said in your last segment, he has just made this wine program sing, offering unique treasures at reasonable prices and helping educate the people that come into this restaurant on wines that they've never seen before, heard before, or tasted before.
We did observe something very interesting last evening. This is just sometimes on the menu has a little bit of fun. So the people sitting at the next table to us last night were having a fine bottle of Pinot, but we noticed that the gentleman drank bourbon through the first three courses. We thought that was kind of an unusual pairing. What do you do in that kind of situation?
Pour them a lot of bourbon. I've in my career seen people do everything. I watched one time four people sit at a fine dining restaurant. Our server went to the table. The three people ordered dinner, and the fourth one ordered five courses of dessert with accompanying dessert wines. We're here to please. We're here to make people feel good, and feeling good is getting what they want. So we'll do whatever it is. This fella happened to drink a lot of bourbon last night. He felt good when he left.
So listeners, when you come, ask for Mickey, ask for Bob Wagoner. You'll have a fine time, I'm sure. Thank you so much for talking to us, Mickey.
Thanks for joining us, and it was great having you here.
Well.
What a pair. Huh? What a pair. And the general manager of the hotel topped the whole thing. I mean, he was sitting right there as part of the group, and we're recording these interviews.
Yeah, and we'll do that.
You'll hear him on an upcoming show.
All right. And well, I think we're winding it up here.
And you'll recognize his accent, too. The British are coming. The British are coming. We'll see you next week. Same time, same place.
Bye-bye.